Everybody, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, but please hold your calls until we specifically ask for them, because we have with us on the line from back in Washington, D.C. area, Stephen Camerota from the Center for Immigration Studies, and we're going to be talking about the invasion of America today. America really is certainly is under attack. Massive numbers of people are coming in here illegally, and certainly they are influencing dramatically our way of life. We're moving from our traditional culture into a multicultural society, a multilingual society, and these things are not happening by accident. With that as a background, Stephen Camerota, thank you so very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Well, just remember, this is an entirely different audience, so you can repeat whatever you had to say before. How serious a problem is this from your point of view?
Well, in many ways, when you stop to think about immigration, there really is no public policy that really touches on so many issues. You know, you can decide, well, do we want to spend a little more on Social Security, a little less? Do we want to spend a little more here or there? But when we think about sort of the most profound issues on our society, who we let in and how many impacts everything, not just the obvious things like schools and hospitals and how many roads and bridges you have to build, but also it has profound influence on your culture, on your politics, on your very future as a nation. And so now you might talk about some of the benefits and costs of immigration, but the point is, unlike so much of the other relatively unimportant stuff that we have a national debate about, immigration, I would argue, is probably the single most important issue confronting the country. But unfortunately, we don't have the kind of national debate that we need.
And I think you're absolutely right. Now, how does it impact upon the average individual? A lot of people are out there sitting around and they say, well, but that doesn't involve me. Or certainly there may be a little bit more violence and a few gangs out there, but that's not going to affect me as long as I live in my nice little community. This isn't going to impact on my way of life. And I think that is a very, very short-sighted view. So could you pick up the idea? Why is this so important for the average American?
Well, I think it actually impacts so many things the average American cares about. I mean, it's difficult to overstate the impact on schools. All of the growth in the last 20 years in the school-age population, and there's been a lot of talk about this, has come from immigration. That is, children of immigrant children, and then the children of immigrants account for all the national increase in public school enrollment in the last 20 years, and this has had a big effect on lots of districts. Public hospitals. It appears that at least three-fourths of the growth in the uninsured population since 1989 is new immigrants or the child of a new immigrant. That is, someone born in the U.S., but to a recently arrived immigrant.
Well, now, because are you including legal and illegal? Or
right,
these
figures include both legal and illegal. The government collects, actually, you might be surprised, some pretty detailed data on things like school enrollment and health insurance coverage and so forth. And that data actually picks up a lot of illegals. We think that, in the 2000 census, 7 to 8 million illegal aliens sent their census forms back.
All right, fine. So basically, of course, we're seeing this effect upon education, but doesn't that cost us, the taxpayers, an awful lot of money?
Right. Well, one of the reasons why it costs taxpayers so much is that immigrants tend to be a lot poorer because they tend to have a lot less education than natives. About a third of immigrants have not completed high school compared to about 8% of natives. What that does, it means that regardless of legal status, they do tend to be a lot poorer, and so they tend to pay a lot less in taxes as a consequence.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Stephen Camerota from the Center for Immigration Studies. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Stephen Camerota, and we're talking about the impact on education and the cost of education. And, of course, we're providing education for the children of people who are here illegally. We're actually subsidizing the education for many of the illegal immigrants going to our colleges and universities. Why would we be doing something like that? This would only encourage people to come here and break our laws.
Right. Well, what's happened in a lot of states like Texas and Kansas and New Mexico and New York and California is that advocacy groups have actually been successful in getting together and pressuring the legislature, say, to pass laws that allow people in the country illegally, if they've gone to a local high school, to actually get in-state college tuition. I think that was one of the things you referred to. Now, in general, of course, the public is outraged. The public can't understand why we would ever do such a thing. But what happens is that the public isn't really paying attention. And the interest groups, on the other hand, pay a lot of attention, and they bring the pressure to bear. And so politicians, you know, kind of respond to what's in front of them, and they pass these kinds of things. Even though, again, if the public knew about it, generally these things wouldn't pass. Nonetheless, with politicians, you know, with the public generally unaware, they do.
Well, of course, Stephen, the bigger question is, who is funding this? Because pressure groups have to be organized. It takes money. They have to certainly pass out favors. They have to have their lobbyists. You and I certainly are not in a position to do that. These pressure groups have a great deal of money. Where is that money coming from?
Right. Well, just very briefly, when it comes to immigration politics and the people who work very hard to make sure the law never gets enforced, it comes from two places. On the one hand, the ethnic advocacy groups, the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund, National Council of Iraq, and so forth, they provide, if you will, sort of the racial politics and the moral outrage, and the business community provides the money and the political muscle. And so together, the two groups work, even though it's a very odd but formidable coalition, work to subvert U.S. immigration law.
But how about the Ford Foundation? Aren't they actively involved in encouraging this illegal activity?
Absolutely. There's no question that there is a panoply of groups. It includes most of the labor major liberal foundations, you know, Pew and Ford and MacArthur and all the ones you might suspect, generally funding research and advocacy on behalf of those who work to undermine the rule of law. Also involved in this coalition is a generally sympathetic media. You have other very important groups that are in possession of very specialized knowledge, like the American Immigration Lawyers Association.
Hold that thought right there, sure. Just for a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Stephen Camerota, and we were simply talking about who is funding the advocacy groups that are pressuring the legislature to allow illegal immigrants to come in and have so many benefits and certainly be able to go to our university, subsidized education and so many of the other benefits that illegal aliens get. And of course, Stephen was saying that a lot of the money comes from certainly from business, and of course it comes from our liberal foundations, from the Pew Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, and yes, the usual suspects are the Ford Foundation. It's certainly one of the major funders of LULAC and Maldaven. And even I saw the other day when Congress had given money to LULAC, which is one of these advocacy groups. Why would Congress be voting to give money to a group that is advocating illegal activity? That doesn't make any sense.
Right. Well, I mean, it's just one of the things that they do. Basically, there are a whole lot of groups that advocate, sometimes quite legitimately, on behalf of legal immigrants and refugees, but who, as part of their day job is to also work to subvert the rule of law. And, you know, that would include groups like, LULAC and the RAZA. These groups generally, they do a whole host of things, and some of which is not related to immigration and working to protect the rights of illegals, and some is. And they have a lot of friends in Congress, though, again, that's the kind of thing that gets stuck onto a much larger bill if you were to call attention to it. Generally, it wouldn't happen. But nonetheless, that's the kind of thing that goes on.
Of course, Stephen was also making the point that a lot of our big business is really behind this. So now, why is big business encouraging people to come here illegally and backing them up? I mean, don't they believe in the law? If they want to change the law, why don't they change it legally rather than supporting illegal activity? And I would think that would be criminal to support illegal activity. Or maybe if you're rich enough, well, you don't have to abide by the law.
Well, remember, things always don't work, you know, clear. Things are not always so black and white. The business community doesn't, you know, pay to set up a print shop so that illegal aliens can get forged driver's license. What they do is, when there was, say, there was an operation called Operation Vanguard, for example, a few years back in Nebraska, where they tried to subpoena all the employment records of meat processors and poultry meat processing plants in Nebraska. Well, it worked really well, and so what the business community did is they put together a lobbying outfit, hired the ex-governor of the state, and they just, you know, pressured the heck out of the congressional delegation, and they basically got the Immigration Service to back off. And, of course, the ethnic advocacy groups, you know, said all the usual things. It's racist, it's unfair, it's mean-spirited, and so forth. And so that, coupled with the money that the business community poured in, basically, so the Justice Department didn't say, well, we're not going to enforce law. What they said is, well, we'll stop now and study the issue, which is really what they said was, we're just not going to enforce the law. So my only point there is, that's how these things usually work. When funding comes up in Congress to, say, fund a national database to allow employers to verify that each new employee that they hire is legally allowed to work in the United States, again, employer advocacy groups, the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, and so forth, they work to make sure that doesn't get any funding.
Are you suggesting this is because they're hiring people who are in this country illegally at a lower wage rate, and they don't have to pay them all the benefits?
Well, it's a lot of things. One is, look, in any situation, what they want is just more workers to choose from, legally or not. If you increase the supply of something, in this case, unskilled labor, you lower its price, and the price of labor is wages and benefits and working conditions and so forth. So that's one of the goals. Second, yeah, sure, there are employers who just like the idea of having illegals. Third, it's partly philosophical. Let's be fair. They figure that, look, it's just not up to the business community to play any role in enforcement. The government needs to control the borders, and we don't want our members to have to do anything in that regard. First off, it's not in our interest. We don't want to do it. It's burdensome. And so, you know, it's not just that they're actively working to subvert the law. I'm sure that, you know, in many ways they might sincerely believe that, look, this isn't something we want to do. So that's how it usually works. And they do these things, you know, behind the scenes. So it's not like they actually say, look, we don't think the law should ever be enforced. Rather, they just make sure that the agency charged with enforcing the law has no political support. They just make sure that the agency in charge enforcing the law has not enough money. They just make sure that whenever it does do anything, it gets its hand slapped. So that's what they do.
All right, now, of course, it was back in, I think, 1985 or 1986 when the Reagan administration had a solution to the problem of illegal aliens. They made them all legal, so we didn't have any more illegal aliens. They were all legal, and I think maybe about 3 million they made legal. But they promised us, of course, that this was only a one-time, it would never happen again, and they were going to guard the border. But more than that, they were going to pass laws that would become a federal crime to hire or knowingly hire somebody who was here illegally. So have they enforced the laws?
No, not at all. I mean, I think everyone recognizes
that. If they haven't enforced the laws, then we've got people who are lawbreakers working in our government. They know what the law is, right, and they refuse to. They're very selective in which ones they enforce, and they put some people in jail for violating the laws, and other
right.
people they don't put in jail. That doesn't seem fair.
No, of course not. I mean, look, just last year there were only 3 employers fined for hiring illegal aliens. The Bush administration, continuing the policy of the Clinton administration in its latter years, has just completely cut back on any kind of enforcement. You know, look, the border's largely wide open. The Bush administration continues let me give you another example. In the aftermath of September 11th, the Social Security Administration started sending out all these letters to employers saying, look, you've got all these employees who have Social Security numbers that we've never issued. They're just bogus. They don't match our records and so forth. Well, immediately the business community and the ethnic advocacy groups got on the Social Security Administration. The Bush administration immediately backed off and stopped sending the letter. So basically the Bush administration not only has chosen not to defend the border, has chosen not only not to go after employers who hire illegals, but it's chosen to let the Social Security Administration knowingly allow millions of people with bogus Social Security numbers work in the United States. It's chosen, for example, to have the Treasury Department write regulations that explicitly, and I can explain in more detail, but allows illegal aliens to open bank accounts, which makes their life a lot easier here. They can receive transfers from overseas and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, these are all choices. And I do think that's the most important thing for your listeners to understand. Illegal immigration is not the weather. It's not something we can't control. It's something that, because of the politics of it, we've chosen not only to just tolerate, but in some ways openly encourage. Now, we could undo that. We could change that policy. But the point is that this is a choice. It's not an inevitable. It's not something that we can't control.
All right, Chris, how much of this has to do with the philosophy of globalization? There are people working within our government who do not believe in the sovereignty of America, who don't believe in our Constitution, who really want world government, and this is one of the stepping stones to it, to move away from a one-language society to a multilingual society, one culture to a multicultural society. Isn't that how you destroy a nation and then merge us into this world government?
Yeah, now, I mean, I don't think that it would be fair to say there's some kind of conspiracy, but there's no question that there are people, you know, throughout the elites in the United States from different perspectives, some from the right and some from the left, who don't take American sovereignty seriously. And actually, there's a whole group, let me give you an example, of liberals who want a whole lot of immigration because they see America as an intrinsically racist and evil society, and that by making America less white, this will break white supremacy and prevent America from doing, you know, the nefarious things that they feel that it'll do. You find that view in some ways not uncommon among black intellectuals and the black elite in the United States, and also sort of the left part of the Democratic Party, that immigration is valuable because it will change the country in this positive way as they see it. Now, on the so that there's that. There's also the idea, again, on the left, to see immigrants as a kind of an aggrieved minority, as illegal aliens, as the next victim of American racism. Now, on the right, what you have, again, a group that does intend to respect U.S. sovereignty, is people who see that individuals living in other countries simply just must have the right to leave and come here to improve their life. This might be called the libertarian or the extreme libertarian perspective. And again, that perspective is also not uncommon in the Republican Party. And that fact, coupled with the desire of the business community just simply to have access to more workers, creates an environment in which some very powerful interests work to subvert the rule of law. Though let me just say this: despite all that, Congress actually did. The House of Representatives passed a pretty darn good bill in December, an illegal immigration bill. It did a lot of things, like go after employers, like authorizing the building of a fence, and a whole lot of other important stuff that I could talk about. Now, the Senate, on the other hand, is much more captive to some of this left-right interests that I've been talking about, that don't see the border as legitimate, that have a whole series of agendas, some economic, some cultural. And the Senate is not likely to actually follow the House's lead. But you have to give the House an awful lot of credit. The Chamber of Commerce, then all the ethnic advocacy groups, the immigration lawyers, everybody pulled out all the stops to subvert it, and the bill actually got better over time, and they added even more enforcement to it. So I don't want your listeners to think it's hopeless. No, we actually had the House of Representatives, one of the Houses of Congress, pass a darn good bill. Now, the Senate's not likely to, except under one circumstance, if they hear from your listeners. I mean, that's the bottom line. You know, they should call someone like our inspector, I suppose, and tell him what they think. I mean, he's going to introduce a bill that's going to be weak on enforcement, have some new guest worker program. At the end of the guest worker program, the illegal aliens are going to be given probably some kind of permanent residence and citizenship. They need to call the president and say, look, we don't support this guest worker. We don't want to make people here illegally, make them legal residents of the United States. If they heard enough from their constituents, they wouldn't go ahead with it.
But, Stephen, there are already the laws on the books. They refuse, actually, to enforce the laws we already have. So let's imagine we have more laws. What would you make you think that if they won't already enforce the laws we have, that they are going to enforce a new set of laws?
That's a fair point. And the way to make them do it it's public pressure. All right.
Well, that's why I do what I do, and I know what you do, why you do what you do. And our guest is Stephen Camerota, who's from the Center for Immigration Studies, and he's back there in Washington, D.C., on the front lines of this battle. America is under attack today. While our attention is diverted to what's going on in Iraq, why we're losing America, not by accident, but by belief, by intent. Well, our guest is Stephen Camerota. Stephen, you were calling, mentioning about how some of the black advocacy groups would certainly be in favor of unbridled immigration. I would think that this would be the last thing that the black advocacy groups would be doing, because certainly what they're doing is they're taking away the jobs from the blacks. I mean, many times, and I hate to say this, but the truth of the matter is that many times blacks cannot get as good jobs as the whites, because for whatever reason they don't seem to be they're certainly not getting the proper education in our public schools here. It's almost like somebody's deliberately dumbing them down. But be that as it may, as the Hispanics come in, they're taking the jobs away from the blacks, and there's really a great deal of friction between the black and the Hispanic in many of our ghettos. So why in heaven's name would the black leaders be advocating something that would actually hurt their black constituents?
No, it's a good question. The answer is simple. They see they're hoping for political alliance. And even though objectively you can argue that it's not good economically, it's not good for their schools, it crowds out, you know, public hospitals, which blacks tend to be more dependent on. Nonetheless, those things are overlooked, and the black leadership in the United States feels that the overall interests of blacks are better served by reducing the share of the population that's white. Given the history of white racism towards blacks, they feel that this is justified philosophically. Now, that's sort of like the big picture. More specifically, what they think is probably much more is feeling in their gut that anyone who wants to enforce the law must be doing it out of a sense of racial or ethnic animus, and ipso facto, therefore, efforts to enforce the law must be illegitimate. Having said all that, there's real rumblings in the black community, which is at the black elite in the United States, is overwhelmingly in favor of high immigration.
Well, of course, I think it's the same way in the white community. I think that the average white person is totally against what's going on. They're totally against unbridled illegal immigration, which is having a profound impact, is bringing new diseases into our country. It is having a profound effect on our hospitals, and many of them are actually having to shut down because they cannot run their emergency rooms, which they're required to have, and have all these people come in not paying their bills, uncompensated. It's driving up the cost of hospitalization for everybody who doesn't have insurance, to the point where if you have to go in the hospital and you don't have insurance, why, you can be bankrupted, a direct result of unbridled illegal immigration. I mean, it's having a profound impact on our educational system, as you pointed out, and crowding our schools out, and meaning that many of our children are not getting good education or the type of education they should. But it's changing the culture of our society. It's lowering the wage standards for the people with unskilled labor. And, of course, I was really so interested. A friend of mine recently went to a meeting of the bank. Person works for the bank, and there were officials from the bank there, from the Federal Reserve Bank, talking to people working for banks, encouraging them to help the people who are here illegally send money out of this country. Now, why would people from our Federal Reserve system encourage people, bank employees, to help people who are breaking our laws here, earning money illegally, send it out of the country? That doesn't help America, does it?
No, probably not. The remittances, which probably total about $30 billion a year flowing out of the United States, in general are not thought to be positive for the United States, though given the size of our economy, it doesn't total that much. No, I mean, what's happened in so many sectors is that everyone kind of gets, they talk about, well, we're going to help the people who are unbanked, or we're going to help Hispanics.
Hold that thought right there, please.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Stephen Camerota from the Center for Immigration Studies back in Washington, D.C. And in just a moment or two, we'll tell you how to get in touch with him and get their excellent information. But I was asking Stephen why it is that, and this is something that a friend had told me, that representative of the Federal Reserve System had put on a meeting in San Francisco recently where representatives of the banks here in the United States, in California, we're told to help people who are here illegally be able to send bank drafts out of the United States back to their homes, and we should do everything to facilitate it. Now, here are people who are here illegally. They're violating our laws. I mean, they're stealing our heritage and our money. And then, of course, we find representatives of the Federal Reserve System encouraging the banks to help them, these lawbreakers who are violating our laws. This just doesn't make sense. Why would the Federal Reserve System be encouraging people who are sending $30 billion out of this country? It just doesn't make any sense. So much going on, it doesn't make sense, Stephen.
Well, what happens is, now, that $30 billion figure, by the way, would include both legal and illegal, because we're not sure when money goes out whether it's legal or illegal. And these are just estimates. Now, what happens is there are lots of low-income, say, Hispanic immigrants, and there's a lot of legal immigrants in the United States who are unbanked. That is, they don't recognize or haven't really opened a bank before. So everyone says, well, gee, that's an issue, so let's think about that, and how might we help? But then that gets all confused and tied up with helping illegal aliens. And so what the Fed might say, or these employees might say, or a bank might say, is, well, look, we're just trying to help low-income people, people who are unbanked. We're trying to target Hispanics. But the consequence of what they do is that they look the other way on legal status. They start opening bank accounts even though someone doesn't have a Social Security number. They open a bank account, and this person says, well, I don't have a Social Security number. I don't have a driver's license. And they say, well, we'll take the Mexican identification card. And although you don't have a driver's license, a Social Security number, get a tax ID number. And then the IRS, which gives them out like candy, there's been all kinds of internal reports showing that the IRS is complicit here as well. The IRS then gives a tax ID number that then the bank takes and uses to fill in the form for the Social Security number. And so that's sort of how this plays out. It doesn't so much play out with a federal employee saying, darn it, let's let illegal aliens open bank accounts. What happens is the IRS gives out tax ID numbers in such a way, and the bank then adopts certain policies, and the Fed just looks the other way. And so what you end up with is a very large share of the people who we were trying to help, the unbanked, the low-income population, we end up also helping getting a whole lot of illegal aliens who we can easily identify because they don't have Social Security numbers and so forth. But nonetheless, that's how it sort of happens. But all that is a conscious choice. That is the key to understanding. Illegal immigration is not the weather. It's not something we can't do anything about.
And, of course, the thing is that we're not trying to enforce our laws. We've not tried to stop them from coming across the border. Very often the Border Patrol people will arrest them and then, of course, tell them, well, we're going to release you on your own recognizance. You're to come back in 2 weeks for a hearing, knowing full well that 99% of them aren't going to come back. Why would they do something that stupid unintentionally?
Well, because we made a choice. We made a choice, A, when we caught someone. Well, look, we could do a couple things. One, we could pressure the country. If they sneak through Canada or Mexico, we could have an agreement with those countries. If it's a Mexican, we just send them back to Mexico. If it's Canadian, we just send them back to Canada. It's when we catch what they're called the third parties, the other than Canadians, other than Mexicans, those countries aren't obliged to take them back, even though they came through their country, which is an interesting issue. We could work out an agreement with those countries where they would take them back, but we never do that because it's not a high priority for this administration, the previous one, going back, you know, years and years. Now, the other thing we could do is build enough detention space to hold those people. But again, as a conscious decision, we don't. And so then we end up with people knowing that we only have so many beds. So people from Brazil fly to Mexico, which they can do with it, which they could do without a visa, come to the border, sneak across, get caught, say, hey, here's my Brazilian passport. Mexico isn't going to take them back, so therefore we say, okay, well, we'll parole you into the United States, and you got to show up in 2 weeks. And, of course, they never do, because if enough people do it, if we only had 2,000 or 3,000 beds to hold people, and they catch, you know, hundreds of people a day, pretty quick all the beds are filled up, and so they're paroling people real quick. Word gets back to Argentina, word gets back to Brazil, word gets back to China, and so people get that you can just come in that way. But that represented a choice. We represented a choice not to immediately put them on a plane back to their home country. It represented a choice not to build the detention space, and it represented a choice not to work out an agreement with Mexico and Canada to take these people who come through their country to sneak into ours. But we, again, because it's been a low priority, because this administration and the one before that and the one before that and each successive Congress has not cared enough about it, we've let this situation arise. So now it And so everyone gets it. Everyone gets that you can game the system. Everyone gets that America is not serious about its laws.
No, maybe our leaders have a different agenda. Maybe they really don't care that they're coming in and, of course, undermining the fabric of our society. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Stephen Kamarata, and he is from the Center for Immigration Studies back in Washington, D.C. And certainly we know that some of our congressmen are very concerned about this and have made this a very real issue. And I know you know Tom, what is his name?
Dan Credo.
From Colorado. Right. He has a fair number of congressmen who are very concerned. They'd like to do something, but there's tremendous active opposition from the Bush administration to actually getting a proper solution. That's almost as if they want this lawlessness to continue. And Chris was...
They would say is they don't want the lawlessness to continue. They don't really want to enforce the law. Their solution is basically, well, let's just... will legalize them. Now, they don't recognize that that itself would be a bureaucratic nightmare. Right now, we give out 1 million green cards a year. If we decide, and the system is completely overwhelmed just with that, imagine trying to carefully screen and vet 11 million illegal aliens who don't have proper documents. The bureaucracy could never handle that. But, of course, the Bush administration ignores that fact and just proceeds with proposals that, oh, yes, we could process that. But that's their position. We'll legalize it. Well, the only problem here from the Bush administration's point of view is not the skill level of the immigrants, not the overall number, it's just that they're illegal. So we'll legalize all the illegal aliens here, and usually it's thought that the illegal alien population grows by about 500,000 a year in the United States. We'll just legalize that, too. We'll just dramatically increase the number of people allowed in on a legal basis each year, and the problem, if you will go away. They ignore the bureaucratic reality. They ignore the fact that the main problem in terms of the fiscal costs of illegal immigration are the low education levels of immigrants, resulting in low wages and high use of public services. And they ignore the fact that you're still dramatically increasing the supply of workers at the bottom end of the labor market, where that's where the poorest American workers are already. And increasing the supply of these workers surely doesn't make sense. They ignore that fact, too, and they just proceed that, look, we'll just legalize it all. And, of course, they ignore the fact that experience suggests that every country that has a legalization generally just encourages more illegal immigration on top of it. Because what happens is the more legal immigrants you get, it's the legal immigrants that tend to pull in new illegal aliens.
Well, do you know of a better way to destroy a nation than what we're doing today?
Well, I mean, clearly things can't continue, but...
But, of course, it is continuing, and they promised us back in the mid-'80s that they would never do this again. They would enforce the laws. They refused to enforce the border laws. They refused to go after the employers who are employing people illegally. They refused, of course, even to allow the local police force to turn illegal immigrants over to the border control. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this afternoon is Stephen Kamarata from the Center for Immigration Studies. And at this point, I'm going to ask you to get out your telephone number or your email or however it would be that people can get the information that your organization puts out, because I know that your organization is on the front lines of this battle.
Yes, anyone can visit our website. It's cis.org, like Center for Immigration Studies abbreviated. So it's cis.org.
cis.org. Now, is there an email or is there a telephone number or anything of that sort?
Well, I think the best way to just get everything and to contact us is through the website.
All right, fine. Is there an email there that people can get in touch with you that way?
Sure. If people would really like to email me, they could email me at sac, sac at cis.org.
Of course, I get things from you regularly on the email, so you must have a fairly substantial email list.
Right. If people were really interested, we run an email list that provides, it's just a straight news service, all the stories and research on immigration on all sides of the issue. We send that out every day, and there's maybe 6,000 or 8,000 people on that. Now, there's also another list you could be on to just get announcements of our new research coming out on the issue as well.
All right, fine. Well, is there any good legislation that our listeners should be supporting. Anything you mentioned, of course, that the House had passed legislation, but will it die at the end of the year, or will it have an opportunity to be introduced now into the Senate?
No, right. There will be something in the Senate. That debate is supposed to start at the beginning of March. That's what I'm hearing. Maybe sometime at the end of February, just not sure. But that legislation is not going to be good. The Senate legislation will create some new guest worker program, legalizing illegal aliens here. And it's not even clear it'll be any kind of a guest worker program, because in the end, the illegal aliens get permanent residency and ultimately citizenship. But that's how they're going to sell it. They're going to say, well, they're guest workers, even though they're all staying. I know it sounds outrageous and ridiculous that someone would say that, but that's what they're going to do. And because, you know, it's just marketing. And I think that, you know, it's not going to, then what happens, as your listeners may know, is that the Senate will pass a bill, this House passes a bill, and then it goes to conference. They come up with a compromise, and it has to be passed again by each House. It's not clear that they're going to be able to work out a compromise. If people think that they would like to see the law enforced, then they need to call their senator and say, I want you to support a bill like the House passed, no guest worker program, enforcement first, or at the border, against employers, and all the other things. We want a bill like the House passed, no guest workers, no legalization. And, you know, if the fact is, if senators heard that enough, you know, congressmen, you know, they're not that committed to the issue. They would buckle, mostly. Now, there are a few ideologues. A guy like John McCain, for example, you know, he's just not very interested in enforcing law. He wants to legalize illegal aliens. He would be very hard to not to convince. And there are lots of other, a lot of Democrats like that. But there are people who can be moved on the issue. And so if they heard from their constituents, but if they don't hear from them, they're just going to listen to the lobbyists, and we're going to get something that doesn't reflect the national interest.
All right, fine. Well, of course, I mean, what we're seeing is the destruction of America, because the figures that I have and the figures that were used by the representative from the Federal Reserve System recently was 20 million illegal aliens in America. I know other people. There's a new book out now, Fighting Illegal Immigration. You used a figure of 11. Isn't it possible that there are a lot more here, that this is really much more of a problem? And if they're really 20 million and we make them illegal, then they'll be able to bring in all of their friends and relatives from south of the border, and soon the America we know will cease to exist.
Well, this is an interesting question. Let me say this. You know, I do weigh in a lot on this debate. This is an area where I focus a lot. I come down on the side of the debate that there's 11 to 12 million for a couple of reasons. Just looking at, say, birth data, most births to people are recorded in the United States. There just aren't enough births. If you look at school enrollment, it's grown dramatically, but it doesn't look like, and it looks like there are a heck of a lot of illegals and children of illegals, but again, the implication of that administrative data from public schools and from public hospitals suggests more like 11 or 12 million, but it's a debate. I recognize that. Let's talk a little bit about the issue of culture. Let me talk about three things I think that are happening. I think that it would be a mistake to say that at least legal immigrants and immigrants in general don't want to assimilate. I don't think that's what's happening. I think there are several factors. One is the numbers. Right now we have about 36 million immigrants in the United States. That's almost triple the number in 1910. As a share of the population, it's a little less than in 1910. But the numbers themselves are so enormous that it tends to overwhelm the assimilation process. A million immigrants can create the kind of linguistic and geographic isolation that's necessary. They can create their own social institutions and media outlets. And so with these huge numbers, it's basically overwhelming the assimilation process. Another factor to keep in mind that's hindering assimilation is technology. In the past, the tie with the home country was broken, partly because a third of immigrants actually come from Mexico. It's so close. But also, even if you come from China, you can call home, you can visit home, you can listen to your hometown radio station on the internet. The tie with the home country isn't broken like it was in 1900 when you had to book a steamboat passage that took a long time and cost you, you know, 5 years' pay. Those days are gone, so that also tends to hinder assimilation. And finally, elite attitudes in the United States are different. In the past, there was a very strong sense that immigrants not only had to learn English and drive on the right side of the road, but also had to come to see American history as their history. as John Fonte of the Houston Institute talks about, the idea of patriotic assimilation was widely shared by the elites in the United States. That's completely gone now. The elites have embraced a very different notion in which assimilation is now seen as derided as a kind of Anglo-conformity, and that they have a much harsher critique of American history, that America's a racist, classist, homophobic country, and immigrants absorb that message as well. Now, they do get some positive messages about the United States. So I guess let me just say three things. The numbers are huge, the technology's different, elite attitudes are different, and finally, the other big thing is that in 1920, basically, 22 and 24, the United States cut immigration dramatically by two-thirds or three-fourths. And for about 60 years, immigration was very low. And that also greatly has helped the assimilation of Italians and Jews and Poles and all that huge flow that we had between, say, 1870 and 1910. And so all that is different now. We're not cutting it off. The technology is different. The elite attitudes are different. And the numbers are just so enormous that they're just overwhelming the assimilation process. But this is, I should point out, different than saying that immigrants don't want to assimilate. I don't think that would be true. And not that I'm saying that you're saying that.
I think that they don't want to learn English. I think that they really want to be Mexicans. In fact, we are doing everything we can to encourage that. We're allowing people who even become citizens here to vote for Mexican elections, just as we're allowing Iraqis who are American citizens to vote into the Iraqi elections.
Right.
What sort of madness is that? Our elite really have an intense effort to change us from being a sovereign nation to be part of this whole global concept. Their loyalty, I don't think, is to America, but to this global dream.
Yeah, I agree with you. This kind of internationalist ideology is deeply troubling, and I do think it's an impediment. It's part of the change in elite attitude. So my position on this would be that we've got to bring those numbers down. The legal numbers are more than 1 million people are allowed to settle in the United States permanently each year legally. The illegal alien population is growing by 500,000 a year. The numbers are just too big. We probably need to cut the total number by maybe two-thirds, bring that down to something more manageable until such time as we change our elite attitudes, and I don't see that happening anytime soon. If you will, the modern world with its technology that I've talked about, with the change in elite attitudes and so forth, just is incompatible with mass immigration. Maybe there was a time when we could assimilate so many people, though again I point out that we did cut it off and keep it low for 60 years, which did greatly facilitate assimilation. But the bottom line is that time has passed.
I do not
believe that in the modern America it makes sense to bring in this many people.
All right, fine. Well, our telephone number, if you'd like to give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, of course, at one time, there were people who wanted English to be the official language of this country. And I remember in 1988, when I was running for Congress, the Republican nomination for the Congress, Senator Hayakawa, who was a Japanese-American, but he was an American, and he was concerned about the lingual aspects, and he wanted English to be the official language of this country. But even in 1988, the globalists were there. They had a different agenda, and they did not want this to be an English-speaking country. They wanted it to be a multilingual country. And so there really are people who have a different worldview than the average American. I don't think the average American understands. There really are people who have no loyalty to this country. Would that be a fair statement to our culture, to our language?
Well, maybe, yeah. I mean, clearly those people exist. There are clearly what I would call anti-Americans, but they actually, I think, make up a small percentage. You know what there are a lot of? Or what we call at the Center for Immigration Study, the phrase was coined by a colleague of mine, Mark Krikorian, the idea of post-American. That is, for their perspective, they've kind of moved beyond their country. They don't so much hate America, it's just that they see national borders and the United States as kind of an anachronism, a throwback to the past, sort of like medieval chivalry. Oh, isn't that quaint that people are patriotic and love their country? But I've moved beyond that. I'm a citizen of the world, that kind of thing. That sort of perspective, that kind of underlying ideology, is very common in American elites. I don't think it's common in American heartland. I don't think most Americans share it, but nonetheless, I do think the elite share it, and that's deeply problematic, and that's one reason why we simply can't have a lot of immigration, because the immigrants absorb that ideology, and that's extremely destructive for the kind of national cohesion that you're talking about. So, but again, I think it, what it is not that they're anti-American, and again, I'm not saying that's what you said. It's not that they're anti-American. They're just indifferent to the country.
Well, I, you know, I would say that they are anti-American. You either love this country and you believe in this country and its ideas, or you would like to see it merge into this global society where our Constitution will no longer exist, where we will, of course, begin to have the same rights and same privileges that the people of other countries do. I think that is a real tragedy. They can tell you everything wrong with America, but nothing right. Well, let's go to Mark, who's calling from Salinas. Mark, do you have a comment or question for our guest?
Yes, I do. Great program today, gentlemen. Question for your guest. I've heard you use the word immigrant a few times on the program today, and I was just curious, when you use that immigrant term, are you including illegal aliens in that, or is that separate from illegal aliens?
Well, various times we've talked about different things. In the terms of there are about 36 million immigrants in the United States, so a little less than a third, we think, 11 to 12 million, are illegally here. And of that 36 million, there's probably about 1.5 million
okay.
who are here on long-term temporary visas.
Okay, so the way you use illegal alien, that's encompassed in the word immigrants, right? I think it's more accurate if you refer to the illegal aliens as illegal aliens and the immigrants. You could say that those are the people filling out the paperwork and properly coming into the country, because words are very important and they mean specific things. And if you use words interchangeably, you can almost make it a haze where it's not discernible. You know what I'm talking about?
It's a fair point, but we need to understand a couple things. There is no clear line between illegal aliens and legal immigrants. I know we'd all like to believe
There's not a difference between illegal aliens and immigrants that come in through the paperwork.
Most research shows. Let me explain. So then you may disagree. So this
okay.
is an important
yeah,
point.
Most
research shows that in any given year, somewhere between 40% and 50% of legal immigrants—that is, new people given a green card—are legal aliens in the United States who are basically laundering their status from within the United States. We know that both from INS administrative records and from the New Immigrant Survey funded by the NIH, and we know that as well from other demographic data.
Okay.
A very large share of people who are legal immigrants in any given year are, as I say, former illegal aliens. We also know from sociological...
I don't mean to interrupt you. You made a good point there, but I know the time's limited.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I had to cut him off because he wasn't going to let you talk. And Mark, I'm sorry, but I don't want to get into a shouting match on this. I personally tend to agree with you, Mark. I am very concerned that we are clouding this issue. I believe it's closer to 20 million. I have those figures from high government officials. But, of course, there's so much here to confuse the issue and whether it's legal or illegal. I think it makes a lot of difference whether you have come here legally or whether you are violating our laws. And a nation that will not enforce its laws, will not maintain its border, is no longer a sovereign nation. Well, let's go through.
Let me just say this. It's true that it's important to understand the differences, but it is also important to understand the interconnectedness of legal and illegal immigration. It would be a mistake to imagine, for example, that we can leave legal immigration high and not have a lot of illegal immigration with it. As I was trying to explain, sociological research shows that one of the best predictors of whether you decide to come to America illegally, say, from your village in Mexico, is if someone has come from your family legally to the United States. It's the legal immigrants who often draw in the illegal aliens.
I think that we have to say, when you come in illegally, you're coming in illegally. Don't say that somebody drew them here. They came in, admittedly, they want a better life. Admittedly, that may have been our economic policies that has impoverished the people of Mexico. What we need to do is solve the problems, but certainly not by destroying this country, which is what we're doing when we encourage illegal immigration. And would you concede that our government policies are encouraging illegal immigration?
Sure. As we've talked about. And just keep another thing in mind. This may not be something that everyone wants to hear, but the research on, say, the fiscal cost, the cost to taxpayers, suggests that it's the legal immigrants who come with very little education who are much more fiscally costly to us than illegal aliens.
Well, why are we letting people in here, coming into this country and then getting onto welfare? People who come to this country should be sponsored. There should be somebody who's responsible for them so they do not get onto
right.
our Medicare, and they do not get onto our welfare. And people who come to this country, it's a privilege to come to this country, but the idea that we would bring people into this country and then immediately let them on the dole is either organized madness or somebody wants to destroy America.
Yeah, except that, remember what happens. Most illegal aliens and most legal immigrants who end up using welfare programs, what happens is they come to America and they work, but they're because of their educational attainment, their income is very low. So they qualify for the child tax payment and the earned income tax credit, and their kids can sign up for free school lunches.
But that is entirely wrong. If people want to come to America, they should not come here and expect to get any largesse from the public treasury. And the fact that we're offering it simply means that we are encouraging people to come and bankrupt our nation.
Self-sufficient. It's a fair point, but I don't think it's reasonable to accept to bring in folks who have, legal Mexican immigrants to the United States have something like 10 or 11 years of schooling on average. So in that environment, they're going to use a lot of public services. I don't see how we can avoid that. Either we select immigrants who are self-sufficient, or we accept the fact that they're going to use a lot of social
then
services.
Then maybe we ought to try to get in people who are self-sufficient.
Fair enough. That is a very reasonable point.
And there are people all throughout the world who love to come to America who are capable, who are well-educated. Why are we bringing in people who can't make a living here? Why are we bringing people who have to go on the dole? It doesn't make sense unless there's another agenda behind our immigration attitude. We've got just a couple of minutes here to wrap up the program. But I think it's so important people understand that nothing going on really makes sense unless there's another agenda. Well, we've got William calling from Wyoming. William, if we've got just a moment or two, would you like to have a question?
Yes, I do. Thanks, Dr. Stan and Mark. I'd like to know why the Border Patrol down, this was on the media just today, why they turned back those Mexican soldiers who were bringing drugs in. Why did they not apprehend them and put them in detention?
Because, of course, we are not really doing anything at all. We wouldn't want to offend any of the Mexican soldiers. There's a very close relationship between our leaders and the leaders in Mexico. And if you have to get into the background of drugs, but our government has been allowing drugs into this country all the time. Since we started our war on drugs, we've got a lot more drugs. Since we started our war on terror, we got a lot more terrorism. We started a war on poverty, we got more poverty. We started a war on cancer, why have we got more cancer? What do these things suggest to you, William?
Well, what I am seeing is something in the way of either graft or corruption.
All right. How would you respond to that, Stephen?
I think that it's basically true that we want to avoid any kind of confrontation with Mexico. So if we catch Mexican officials in the United States, even if we suspect them of drug trafficking, we generally, at the border anyway, don't want a confrontation. So we try to avoid it. And basically that's what's happening.
Does that answer your question, William?
You have a nice day.
God bless, and thanks so much. Okay, well, I want to thank you so very much for being with us. Once again, would you like to get out your website so people would know how to get in touch with you?
Sure. Our website, again, is cis.org, like Center for Immigration Studies, abbreviated.
All right, well, thank you so very much for being with us, and I'll look forward to having you again when something new comes along.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, that was Stephen Camerota from the Center for Immigration Studies. So much of what's going on doesn't make sense, unless you understand that there is a move towards world government. It is the major driving force behind everything, behind the First World War and the Second World War and the Spanish-American War and the Boer War and the Korean War and the Vietnam War. And none of them were fought to win. They were all fought to bring about a world government. And when you understand that, when you understand that the leaders of this country, of both political parties, have no loyalty to America but to this globalist dream. Do you remember the debates between George Bush and John Kerry? Neither one of them wanted to bring up the immigration issue. Neither one of them wanted to stop illegal immigration to this country. Both of them have exactly the same dream because both of them came from the same secret society. They were both Skull and Bones members, and both of them would say, this is such a secret society, we can't even discuss it. I would like to think that if a man was the President of the United States, he would renounce his allegiance to the secret societies and be loyal to America, but apparently that isn't the case. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I really do understand immigration. We have certainly a great new four-tape set on immigration. We have a book called Importing Immigration. Much of this is funded by the Ford Foundation, and that's the basic theme of this book, written by a former congressional. Fighting Immigration is the title of it. Fighting Immigration Anarchy, but we also have another book called Importing Immigration. So we have Importing Immigration and Fighting Immigration Anarchy. And then, of course, we also have four-tape set on immigration. And I hope we still have copies of that excellent video by Glenn Spencer on the conquest of Aztlan. Then you'll actually hear the Mexican activists talking about taking America and how those of your Anglos better get ready to go back to Europe where you belong. You have to understand all of this is simply to inflame the European people here. To divide us from the Mexicans. The Mexicans are being manipulated in this whole thing. Even the people who are coming in here illegally are being manipulated. Because, of course, what they really want is racial strife. They want to be able to play one group against the other. Mexican against white, white against black, black against Hispanic. This is the old idea of divide and conquer. There really are people who are moving to plunge us into a one-world government. And they really want a dictatorship in America. Our boys are going overseas to fight for freedom. We're losing our freedom at home. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. My producer says we no longer carry that video. But we do carry the books. We talked about Importing Revolution, Fighting Immigration Anarchy, and our new four-tape set, great new four-tape set on immigration. You need to have the information. You need to understand that behind everything going on, there is another agenda. And, of course, we're being drawn into another confrontation, expanding the war in the Middle East, and I really fear for my country. That I reflect that more and more people are going to die, not only in the Middle East, but I fear that there will be retaliation here at home, because men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. Now, your job is to find out if what we're saying is true. You should get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You should get our pamphlets on the occult hierarchy that rules the world. You should get the book written by the Librarian of Congress, James H. Billington. It's called Fire in the Minds of Men, that will tell you the world revolution is all about occult secret societies. And, of course, he only takes you up to the time of the Cuban Revolution. Since he's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and one of the leaders, he's not going to tell you the whole story, but he tells you more than most other people will. There always have been secret societies that were founded in the occult and were dreamed of creating a world government. So again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. You need to get the book, Importing Revolution, Fighting Immigration Anarchy. You need to get the four tape set on immigration. You need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. We have a little pamphlet on We Are a Republic, another one on the history of money, another one on genetic engineering. It gets into, of course, the vaccines, and, of course, the deadly effect of some of those vaccines. Did you know that the homosexuals who were foolish enough to take the hepatitis B experimental vaccine back in 78 and 79 in San Francisco, over 75% came down with AIDS, and most of them are dead? I wonder why so many of those got who took that vaccine, because it wasn't that prevalent in the rest of the homosexual society. Do you think there might have been something in the vaccine? Well, you need to get, of course, our latest talk. It's called Planned Population Reduction. That's Planned Population Reduction. You will never look at the world through the same eyes again. It's either a video or a DVD. Talk we gave for the Prophecy Club, and if you can stand listening to me talk for 2.5 hours, I think you'll learn an awful lot. And of course, there are a lot of other graphics and other things there to make it break up the monotony. But I'll tell you, the people who've seen that video have told me it changed their life forever. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Remember, we do carry the Berkey products. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.